Hello and welcome. You're listening to The Broadband Exchange, the podcast from your friends at Telecompetitor. I'm Ian Descher, Pivot's Director of Media and Story and Managing Editor of Telecompetitor. It's time to review this week's broadband news. Let's get into it. The headline story this week came from the satellite side of the broadband business, where Amazon made a pair of moves intended, among other things, to make them a strong competitor against Starlink. Amazon said it signed a definitive merger agreement to acquire Globalstar, and it also announced a partnership with Apple to support connectivity services for iPhone and Apple Watch users. Assuming the transaction closes as planned, Amazon will acquire Globalstar's satellite operations, infrastructure, assets, and spectrum licenses for their Amazon Leo satellite broadband service. Amazon Leo is clearly not thinking small. It's trying to build scale, deepen its satellite capabilities, and move quickly into consumer-facing connectivity. The partnership with Apple is an interesting twist to that story. Globalstar already supported satellite connectivity for Apple devices, including iPhone 14 and later models, along with the Apple Watch Ultra 3. Under the new arrangement, Amazon said it would continue supporting the devices that already relied on Globalstar's satellite constellation and those still to come. So, with this Globalstar deal, Amazon isn't just buying capacity, it's also stepping directly into a more visible role in the race to connect users beyond the reach of terrestrial networks. It's a strategic effort to blend satellite assets, devices, and future mobility partnerships into one broader platform. That story also landed in a week when federal policymakers were leaning hard into space-based broadband. The FCC released a report and order aimed at revisiting the old rules that govern how geostationary and non-geostationary satellite systems share spectrum. According to the agency, the proposed changes could create more than $2 billion in economic benefits and increase the capacity for space-based broadband services by as much as sevenfold. The FCC said the current framework relies on late 1990s limits that no longer reflect what modern satellite systems can do. Under its chairman, Brendan Carr, who is bullish on satellite broadband and increasing spectrum availability, the FCC wants to modernize the rulebook so the next phase of satellite broadband can move faster and carry more traffic. Put those two stories together, and the pattern is hard to miss. Private investment and public policy appear to be moving in the same direction. Amazon moved to bulk up its satellite operation and link it to one of the world's biggest device ecosystems, while the FCC moved to loosen rules that it believed were constraining next-generation systems. For rural broadband providers and anyone tracking competitive dynamics, this is a reminder, not that you probably needed it, that satellite isn't content to remain a niche backup option. It wants a bigger seat at the broadband table. Another spectrum and policy story added to that momentum. The NTIA and the Commerce Department announced that the 2.7 GHz band had cleared a key technical review and is now available for full-power commercial licensed use. NTIA described the band as offering a strong mix of coverage and capacity, with the ability to serve whole neighborhoods, including indoor coverage, while also supporting the wider channels needed for next-generation applications. That doesn't mean new commercial use shows up overnight, but it is another sign that federal agencies are trying to put more usable spectrum into play, which is central to long-term wireless and fixed wireless planning. The FCC was also busy reminding providers that build obligations still matter. In a decision involving RDOF, the Rural Digital Opportunity Fund, the commission denied waiver requests from Mediacom wireless entities in Florida and Georgia and from Consolidated Communications. The request centered on milestone requirements tied to the number of locations that had to be served by the end of 2025. The FCC seemed to be making a broader point here, not just ruling on these two specific petitions. They seemed to also be saying that RDOF was designed to avoid a flood of exception requests like those from Mediacom and Consolidated, and that participants were expected to live up to the framework they agreed to. At the state level, Oregon, otherwise known as Home Sweet Home to Me, announced $6.8 million in digital connectivity technology program grants. The funding will support internet-enabled devices and public Wi-Fi equipment for underserved communities. Awardees include libraries, colleges, nonprofits, and tribal and community organizations across my fine state. On the infrastructure side, Ziply Fiber announced that its 400-gig Northern Link route was now fully live between the Pacific Northwest and Chicago. The route spans roughly 2,100 miles and is aimed at customers who need ultra-low latency, high-capacity transport. That includes hyperscalers, financial institutions, and data center operations. Lightsource Communications made a similar announcement about the completion of its dark fiber route between Amarillo, Texas, and Tulsa, Oklahoma. These two stories are core industry stories. Providers investing in transport, route diversity, and capacity where wholesale and enterprise demand justify it. That part of the market doesn't grab consumer headlines, of course, but it remains foundational to everything built on top of it. Also this week, Segra made a business services move by launching SkyVoice, a unified cloud communications platform for customers across its footprint. The company said the service will combine voice, collaboration, and contact center capabilities in one environment and support integrations with platforms including Salesforce, Microsoft Teams, Zendesk, NetSuite, and HubSpot. This was one of those stories that illustrated how fiber operators keep trying to move up the stack. Connectivity remains the anchor, but the value proposition increasingly includes managed communications, workflow integration, and tools that make a provider more embedded in a customer's day-to-day operations. Brightspeed, meanwhile, rolled out a simpler and very practical retention play with its new service called Easy Move. The idea of this Easy Move service is to make residential moves less painful by allowing customers to move their Brightspeed service without starting over, keep their pricing history, bring their equipment, and continue using the same account tools and support channels. This is an interesting model for other providers. This is an area where retention might just come down to removing friction from life events that give customers a reason to reconsider their options. Moving from one home to another is one of the biggest of those moments. Brightspeed's pitch is essentially that changing homes shouldn't be a hassle, at least as far as internet is concerned, and shouldn't require changing your entire broadband relationship. In wireless marketing news, Verizon won a challenge over its four lines for $25 per line promotion. The BBB National Programs National Advertising Division ruled that Verizon had adequately disclosed the future price increase tied to the offer. T-Mobile had argued that Verizon's advertising didn't convey clearly enough that the $25 price was a 36-month promotional rate that later rose to $30 per line. The NAD sided with Verizon, saying the disclosure was sufficient and that the increase aligned with reasonable consumer expectations over a three-year period. The national wireless players are in these kinds of advertising disputes all the time. The reason that we at Telecompetitor take time to cover them is that these disputes provide helpful insights, I think, about what you should and shouldn't be saying in your own advertising. The Wireless Broadband Alliance released a set of Wi-Fi security guidelines this week, which are aimed at bringing more consistency to protections across public, enterprise, and roaming environments. The group said the standards are intended to reduce risks such as rogue access points, credential theft, privacy breaches, and signaling attacks. It also argued that a more uniform approach would improve trust and interoperability. For broadband providers, especially those active in managed Wi-Fi or public access environments and enterprise networking, these standards are a helpful reminder that Wi-Fi users don't only care that the network works, they increasingly expect the experience to be secure and predictable wherever they connect. Finally, in Telecompetitor's monthly Artificial Intelligence newsletter, we featured an article on digital agriculture and the National Science Foundation's AI Ready America initiative. We explored how broadband providers can play a role in bringing AI tools into rural communities. The story pointed to a new National Science Foundation funding opportunity that would support AI-ready coordination hubs in every state, with backing from the U.S. Department of Agriculture's National Institute of Food and Agriculture and other agencies. The key takeaway was that there are real opportunities for rural broadband providers around the growth of AI in digital agriculture. Both the National Science Foundation and the National Institute of Food and Agriculture told us that broadband providers can be key players in these state coordination hubs. That's it for this week. Thank you so much for listening to the Broadband Exchange. You can read all the articles we talked about today at telecompetitor.com. Feel free to drop us a line while you're there. Thank you again for joining us, and we will see you next week.